Hello, and welcome to this week's Next Sense Institute podcast. My name's Trudy Smith. I'm the Manager of Continuing Professional Education at the Next Sense Institute and your podcast host. We're continuing our series this term looking at research, particularly research to do with anybody with sensory and other disabilities. And it's my very great pleasure to have Kathleen Tait with me today. So welcome, Kathleen. Please introduce yourself to the audience for us.
Thanks, Trudy. Hi, everyone. My name is Kathleen Tait, and I'm employed as an associate professor at the School of Education at Macquarie University. And my passion has been to work with families who are raising children with all sorts of different disabilities, try and help them to connect with services, connect with other families, and just to make their life just a little bit easier. And that's me.
Fantastic. And so we are talking about the family quality of life research that you're conducting. But I wonder, Kathleen, to begin, if you could define what you mean by quality of life.
So an easy way to understand the concept of quality of life is to think about the degree to which an individual is healthy, they're comfortable, they're able to participate in or enjoy life events. So some primary indicators of quality of life include having sufficient income, having job satisfaction, decent housing, access to high quality education, a reasonable work-life balance. I say that as a joke. Rewarding personal relationships and access to cultural and life activities. So quality of life really embodies this sort of overall well-being and happiness concept, but it also includes access to school, work opportunities, maybe an absence of military conflict or threats, which is pretty prevalent in the world at the moment, as well as good physical and emotional health. So it's relative, it's subjective. It's based on individual perception. It has intangible components such as spiritual beliefs and cultural influences and a sense of belonging.
Sure. So what do we need to know about the family quality of life for families who are raising children with vision impairment?
Well, researchers think they know what contributes to people's quality of life and life satisfaction. And there is becoming a growing interest, research interest in the field of quality of life of parents or families raising children with vision impairment. All aspects of the family are affected when a child has special education needs. And this includes the family, parents, siblings, extended family, friends, neighbours. The family functioning is impacted in a range of ways. There are positive outcomes, and these include maybe an increase in a strength within the family, resilience, cohesion, community connection. Parents raising a child with a disability often face numerous challenges. I mean, that's a given, I think. And this could be encompassed in terms of social isolation, emotional stress, it could be depression, grief, financial problems. So the emotional and support needs of children with vision impairment and their families are often quite complex. What I found interesting in my beginning research in this field is I went and had a look at what the literature was actually saying about quality of life of families raising children with a vision impairment. And there's very little that's been written about it. There was one project that was conducted in 2018 where they looked at peer-reviewed journal articles for the last 10 years, and between 1996 and 2016, and publications that they came up with only came to 37 publications on family quality of life in families raising children with vision impairment. Now that was 10 years ago.
Wow.
Those 37 papers, there was nothing written about Australia, not one paper. So more and more we're getting, more interested, researchers are getting more interested, I think families and support services are getting more interested in the concept of, what is the impact of raising a child with a vision impairment on the family?
Absolutely. It sounds like really necessary research. And so having now conducted this research in Australia, what have you found?
I've been very lucky to work internationally. So I've conducted some quality of life and impact on raising a child with a disability in general, not children with vision impairment specifically. So I worked for 7 years in East Asia. So when I worked with Chinese families living in Hong Kong, and I want to preface this information with the fact that there's, you know, one size does not fit all. I almost want to put that tattooed across my forehead so I don't complain. But this is general information given to me by the families who I interviewed. And obviously everyone is different. But in terms of Hong Kong and China, mainland China, there's definitely the issue of a stigma of disability in that culture. So for many Chinese families, a child with a disability is considered very bad luck. And there can be a huge social stigma attached to having a child with a disability. So the belief that disability is somehow linked to a wrongdoing in the past, a bad omen. So culturally, they feel it reflects badly on the parents, particularly the mother. So the stress that cultural influence places on people. So the concept of filial piety is one that's very strict in the traditional Chinese perception of virtual and moral standing. And it's a system of reciprocity. So the concept is that parents take care of their children and then the children take care of their parents when the parents are not able to. So you can understand now if you have a child, particularly when the one child only policy for families was in place in China. You've got one child who's supposed to be the one who's going to look after you in your old age. There is a very long wait for assessments and support services in mainland China and in Hong Kong. The other thing that I found was that there were many support services that only worked from 0 to 8 years because the concept of the golden time or the catch-up time, the whole idea was, okay, the child has a disability, but we'll just put them into an intervention program and they'll catch up. Yeah. So we don't need anything more than 8 years.
Yeah.
So there were just no special schools for children who are of secondary age, and inclusive education is still very much in the early phase in Hong Kong and mainland China. When I worked in Brunei has an Islamic philosophy or cultural background, and that's a very different influence in the field of raising a child with disability. Verses of the Quran are used by Muslims to protect children from the harmful effects of what's known as the evil eye or the jinn. The jinn's the evil spirit that they believe causes the disability. And conversely, in Islamic cultures, and again, I'm saying this is a very generic, that everyone's different. One size does not fit all. mothers also believed, or you know, families believed that having a child with a disability was their fate, their divine intervention, and that God, their God, Allah, chose them to care for a child with a disability. So rather than it being a stigma of disability, the child was seen as a special gift from Allah and allowed them to pave their way to their paradise, their heaven. So helping children with disability, helping them with patience and kindness is a means of reward for Islamic families. It's observed in many instances that these children bring their parents and their family closer to Allah. So a really different perspective culturally.
Completely different. Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then I've done two projects in Australia, one with rural and remote families. And I used a quality of life indicator there where we looked at children who were in a setting that was in a rural district located in far New South Wales. The study covered a large geographical region with relatively low population density, and that led to greater challenges in accessing services. Obviously, I'm not saying anything here that someone from a rural area wouldn't say themselves. That, you know, it's better to be living in a metropolitan city. You're going to have access to more services. So the challenges for that study included a combination of considerable distance to services on very narrow country roads, and where some areas you're driving and you've got hazards like sheep, where you've got native animals, kangaroos, livestock, cattle on the roads. It can be hundreds of kilometres to get to the service. You've got limited availability. It's hard enough to get an appointment with your hairdresser now, but you know, trying to get an appointment with a specialist extremely difficult. In most cases, people had to drive to the city. They had to stay overnight. Now, when you've got cattle, when you've got sheep, when you've got animals at home, you can't just leave for the day. You can't certainly not leave for a week. So that means usually one parent had to stay at home, another parent had to stay in the city. That's terrifying when you're not used to, you know, knowing how to get around, where you go. So the other thing that parents raised as being an issue for their quality of life was teaching staff just not being trained in the relevant disability area, and not having an understanding of, you know, what was needed. So that was working with rural and remote families. Was, yeah, literally the distance that it took, the turnover of staff, because you'd get some staff that would come out, but they wouldn't come out for long. Then they go back to a job somewhere in the city. So having that frequent turnover of staff, and it takes a while to establish a level of trust with whomever you're speaking to, because it's quite personal.
Absolutely. You know?
So, yeah, having that frequent turnover of staff, access to funds was one thing. You could get access to funds, but then you couldn't spend the funds because there's no services to there's nobody to come and help. I had one situation of a nurse who could get much greater level of pay if she worked on the weekend as a nurse, but she couldn't get anyone to look after her child on the weekend. She could from Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, but now she would have to work the whole week then. So, you know, there are things that you don't really take into consideration when you're living in a rural, remote area. The other area, the other study that I had recently done was looking at quality of life for adults with intellectual disability between 30 and 50 year olds. So in this case, rather than speaking to the and gathering information from the families about the children, we were targeting the people who had disability, the adults. And I think that was, I think that's very important too. You get one perspective when it's the family, it's another perspective when you are talking to the person who has the disability. And the results of the quality of life study indicated that most of the participants had 303 adults who were happy to complete the study with us. And it was an anonymous survey. So we posted out a survey. They agreed. We posted out via an organized, via a support service. So it was totally anonymous. And they posted the completed survey back to us. And what I found really interesting was it was just a survey. It was what we call closed questions, like it questions. So do you agree, disagree, don't know, really, this is all, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. And then there were some open questions if they wanted to fill in anything. But we got about 200 extra comments just written on the paper.
Wow.
So people were actually writing comments, wanting. I had some people sending their phone numbers saying, I'd love to talk to you about this.
I want to talk more about it.
Yeah, it's exactly what I prefer to do. But a lot of time with research projects, the ethics application is so strict that, now, you won't get your project approved unless it is anonymous. Sure. But then that puts a, you know, a gap between. Yeah. So,
Do you think that's because that just no one's ever asked them before how they're doing, how they're going?
It very much could be, and it very much depends. The answers to the like it questions or the closed answer questions very much depended on who answered, because we gave the option of, if you're able, please complete the survey yourself. If you'd like someone to help you, so they ask the questions, you give the response, they write on the paper for you, or someone just completes it for them. We had all the variables. And it really made a huge difference as to, you know, who was answering the questions. So we looked at different variables like independence and social belonging, social satisfaction, and some of the comments that came back. So what the question was, may you have a pet if you want it? Now, these are 30 to 50-year-olds. Mm-hmm. May you have a pet if you want to? And we had people say, no, I want a dog, but they said no. Another one said, I have a housemate who's allergic. Well, that can happen to anyone.
Yeah.
But we had, you know, it was a rental property violation or it's just not allowed. For social belonging, there was a question that said, do you have friends that come over to visit your home? And I had 8 comments. 4 of them were, so yes, my family comes over. And so the family was their friends.
Right.
Another one said they can't get here because they don't drive. Another one said only if a worker brings them. So really reliant on other people. Then there was a question, this one really got to me, was do you have a key to your home? He's a 30 to 50-year-old. Mm-hmm. Do you have a key to your home? The four of them said, no, I'm in 24-hour care. Six said they resided at a group home and were supervised 24/7 by the on-site staff. One person said specifically, it's locked when the staff member is out. I can't go home by myself without a staff member. And another person said, I have to wait until a staff member is there to get into my unit.
Oh, my goodness. That's awful. There's no dependence in there, is there?
No. 30 or 50-year-olds. You know, you kind of think by then we should be looking at, you know, a reasonable level of independence. So in terms of the satisfaction variables, so how satisfied are you with your current home or living arrangement? That's the question. One person said, I want more control over what I do and where I do it. Another one said, and this is a female participant, said, usually I have to go around with all the men in a group as there's only one staff member.
Terrible.
Another one said, you know, I want to do things I want, not what others say. Another one said, I can't do what I want. So that's that information, those stories are what I want to get out. And that's why Absolutely. I publish and why I research in this area. Because I think you're right, these questions aren't asked. And these were just, you know, this was a valid, reliable, published survey that had been used, you know, multiple times. It's just important. And I like to do a survey just to get people thinking about the issues, but then do a follow-up interview. And you can really get their stories.
Absolutely. I think that's surveys are great for giving you a sense of the field, but then you need the stories, which is where the interviews are so important.
Yeah.
And so how can this type of research influence approaches taken by groups like service providers and individual practitioners? What can we be doing with this new knowledge?
The study of the experience of caregiving for a child with vision impairment and the impact of quality of life on parents and carers, as I said, is gaining interest. And although published literature has been very scarce in recent years, I'm doing my best to get some publications out there. So please read my work. However, I find the current research efforts remain very eclectic. Eclecticism means that it's a conceptual approach that doesn't really hold a valid, it doesn't really allow for multiple theories, and it draws upon multiple theories. The research tends to be a set of interview questions that are just developed on the spot by the researchers, or they'll have a set of closed questions. And this form of research makes it very difficult to replicate and very difficult to pinpoint which approach is being more successful. Specific tools to assess quality of life of parents and children of visual impairment are very scarce. So you get generic. There's a lot of valid and reliable, very good surveys and scales identifying the impact of raising a child with a disability already prepared. But there's not any, there's one, in fact, that I found that actually focuses on congenital glaucoma, which, you know, is a recent one. But that's just one form of vision impairment. So most of them are fairly generic. I could talk about the different kinds of scales, but your readers want to be bored with that information. Some very good ones out there. I probably would say that. I'd say that current research really indicates that parents raising children with visual impairment require better and more extensive information and guidance. A lot of the work's been on helping them to understand the diagnosis of their child's condition, and that's very important, but I think there's more to raising a child with a disability, and that's for families to become aware of the available resources and services. I had in some of my own research, I had parents saying, you know, I just assumed my child would have to go to the local special school. Mm. You know? And so that's where I put all the people I've spoken to, no one said you could enroll your child in the local school.
Local mainstream, yeah.
Yeah, just have this assumption. I've worked with other parents who had their children at home thinking that they were just too disabled to send them to school. Now, so becoming aware of the available resources and services and receiving support on how to manage and adjust to the situation. It's also been identified that the presence of a social network has a positive impact on empowerment. I try, once I know of groups of parents, I try to put them together, someone who's got an older child with that disability, to help someone who's just had a child diagnosed.
Absolutely.
So that they can, don't fall into this trap, you know, or don't go here, try there, or, you know, my advice is do this. So empowerment of persons with a vision loss over their quality of life is a really important factor for actualising their personal life goals. And frontline personnel, as you said, you know, how can service providers, how can this research help service providers? I think frontline personnel should aim to develop positive self-image in persons with vision loss and help provide environments that will empower the consumers. Inclusion is perhaps the most widely discussed practice in regard to people with disabilities, and my view is that for effective inclusion to occur within schools and work settings, the right kinds of supports and resources must be available for the individual, the family, as well as the frontline personnel. It's not about place. So we're getting a lot of talk about inclusion and the right of people to be in mainstream schools. I have no problem with that whatsoever, providing that's the right place for that child, that they're getting the correct support. Just being placed in a school doesn't necessarily mean that's actually the best place.
No. And you're right. It really is about just asking, you know, what do you need and what can we provide realistically?
Yes.
This child. But I want to come back to that. You know, the importance of that parent-to-parent support, I think, can sometimes be in terms of the power of it. None of us has a child with a sensory disability. We haven't lived that experience. We don't know what's available locally. We don't know that it's okay some days to feel like this is all too hard, and other days we have absolute triumphs. And I think that bringing parents together is incredibly powerful, both for sharing information and just being a support network to each other about what it's like as a parent with that lived experience, and also people with lived experience of the disability themselves providing advice to those new families too, so that they can see what the future might be for their child.
Absolutely. Transition from preschool to primary school is a difficult time because parents lose that social network. And then similarly going from primary school to secondary school. So each transition is a mark of development of what we'd expect any child to achieve. But there's also that loss of, you know, the connection that you had, the other children in the school, the other families that you have connection with. So it's all really important. Inclusion is a big issue. Professional values, I think, are really critical to the success of both the consumer and the parents or the caregivers, and their values must reflect the desire to assist reluctant parents to come to terms with the child's vision loss or disability. There is a lot of upset in families. As I said, with that particular group culturally, Chinese tend to start looking at blame, fingers are pointed. And that's something that professionals need to be aware of, that it's devastating. Coming to terms, it can be devastating. Other families, if they have a history of other family members with that disability, it's not devastating. No, they understand. It's like, hey, let's go. You know, we know what to do, kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think that one size does not fit all. Everyone's an individual, and you're going through, you know, you could change. We all change over as we get older. Our perceptions change. So just having the information and being able to make a choice so you feel as though you're in control and someone else isn't telling you what to do is important.
Absolutely, absolutely. And thank you for asking the question of this group and making sure, you know, checking in, how is everything for you? And certainly it's up to us now as a field to respond to their responses.
Yes. And also I think one important thing is to remember that they are the recipients, the families are the recipients of the service. And then there's the service providers. The service providers aren't in control. But often they have that power because they're offering a service that the parents might not feel they're in control, but I would like parents to feel as though they are paying for that service. So you go to the dentist, you're paying for a service. The dentist isn't the powerful one. You are.
Yes.
So the parent, as far as I'm concerned, the parent's the powerful one. But it's enormously difficult. I found with my research in East Asia, families were very happy to talk to me. And my research assistants would say, oh, Dr. Tate, your research is so sad. I said, but the parents, it's cathartic, you know, because they didn't have anyone to talk to. Because it was seen as a social stigma, they couldn't speak to the child's school. They didn't want the children identified as having a disability. It's because if they were identified as having a disability, they could not enroll in a school, in a regular school. And there's so few special schools that they might be on a waiting list to get into. So they just didn't want anyone to know. They couldn't talk about it. So when they would come and speak with me, they would speak for hours because they could. I didn't hold any power over them.
Yes.
I wasn't going to say no to a school or no to a service or no to funding. I was just interested in their story and wanting to tell it. And a lot of them said, I'm so happy that you'll tell our story. And they knew it was anonymous. You know, no names are ever mentioned in research. So I'd just like to empower parents, help them to feel they are the most important, and their child.
Absolutely, and that's a message.
I'll get off my high horse now.
Not at all. No, that's absolutely a message. We regularly talk to families about parent choice and informed choice and then supporting that choice and recognising that the parents are the people who should have the power to choose whatever they believe is the right direction for their child.
Yeah, yeah. And it can be overwhelming going to a case meeting where you've got, you know, five or six different professionals and you there. And even worse if the child is there as well. It's almost like, you know, they're on show. It's
There are certainly challenges to the way that we manage support. So, again, thank you for asking the questions and sharing this with me. We really appreciate your time. If anyone has any questions, we will put Kathleen's contact details in the show notes if you want to follow up or links to particular articles that are relevant too. So, Kathleen, thank you again for talking to me today.
Oh, Trudy, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been wonderful.
It's a pleasure. And we will talk to you all again next week about the next piece of research. For now, take care.